Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. Well, this is the kind of very busy week that causes many people to ask, what have the media learned from the 2016 election? Last week, Senate Republicans refused to bring witnesses to the impeachment hearings. This week, all Senate Republicans except Mitt Romney voted to acquit Donald Trump, who gave a blistering State of the Union speech, followed by a vitriolic and mocking acquittal speech. Joining us to discuss media coverage are two reporters who used to work for major newspapers. Dan Frumkin is the founder of Presswatch, a media project that monitors political reporting and encourages more responsible, informed, and informative campaign and government coverage of the 2020 election. Presswatch says, we are entering a critical period in American politics and American political journalism is not up to the task. Donald Trump's campaign and presidency have exposed and exploited chronic weaknesses like never before. Over 12 years at the Washington Post, Dan Frumkin served as editor of the website and wrote its popular White House Watch column. After he left, he contributed to The Intercept and The Huffington Post, and now he writes and founded Presswatch. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be here.
Great to have you. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who has covered Donald Trump for decades. David is the best-selling author of 7 books, including The Making of Donald Trump, and It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is the founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. They focus on what politicians do rather than what they say. And David is a former longtime award-winning reporter with the New York Times. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Rose.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do on the Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, David, let's start with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
You know, the last two times I was on, you didn't ask that question, so I thought we'd drop that. I'm sorry. Oh. I didn't pick something out. I apologize.
All right. That's all right. What about you, Dan? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, as it happens, I was going to start off on a positive note anyway, because this morning's coverage of Donald Trump's explosive, vitriolic, victimized rant was actually surprisingly good. In the major news outlets, it seemed like they couldn't avert their eyes from the lunacy this time. And so if you look at the Washington Post, the New York Times, AP, they actually kind of addressed head on just how sort of unhinged he sounded and how bitter and angry and how that, you know, sort of augured a continuation of the Trump follies rather than a diminution.
So what do you think, why the change? Because you wrote a pretty long piece called The Profoundly Abnormal State of the Union, and you quote several outlets from the Post to the Times about how they kind of just made it sound like any, quote, normal speech. So what was what changed?
I guess the State of the Union wasn't quite crazy enough for them to finally sort of write in the properly sort of gobsmacked tone. Although, interestingly enough, the column that I wrote about the State of the Union did sort of tip the hat to the Washington Post. It was interesting to look at, really just to compare side to side, the New York Times and the Washington Post coverage of the State of the Union address, because the New York Times one was literally stenographic. It literally just had quotes from Trump and a little bit of context, and then, you know, something about Pelosi. And the Post story was much more of the kind of story that you would get if you were talking to a human being who had just watched the State of the Union. And it talked about how a lot of the stuff he said wasn't true, how it was incredibly stagey and sort of like a reality TV show, and so theatrical. And so I actually gave quite a lot of kudos to the Post, David Nakamura, who wrote that story in the Post on right after the State of the Union address. By contrast, the Times with Michael Shear and Peter Baker both just wrote just dreadful, sort of really lame stuff which illustrated the biggest problem in sort of the daily coverage of Trump in the mainstream media right now, which is that they try to make it sound like everything is normal. And they use their normal algorithms and they use their normal adjectives. And those just aren't appropriate anymore.
What do you think, David? Do you think that most media, major media, are still trying to make it sound like everything is normal?
Well, I think what they're doing is following the standard conventions of journalism. And I think Dan's analysis here was quite correct, particularly about the contrast between the way the Washington Post and the New York Times covered the State of the Union. Most journalism consists of accurately quoting what sources said happened yesterday. Governor Newsom gave a speech. The mayor of San Francisco signed a bill. A company announced its earnings. The conventions of journalism are not set up to deal with someone who is a con artist and a criminal who's in a government position. And it isn't just Trump. Go back to the collapse of our economy 12 years ago. That was brought about when some executives got control of companies, particularly one called Countrywide in California, and they ran them as frauds. Business coverage normally follows on the principle that, well, the executives may be sort of taking care of themselves and getting themselves paid too much, but they're running the company for the shareholders. And as Bill Black has shown, he's the guy who's responsible for over 800 executives going to prison in the savings and loan scandal. You can also run a company as a fraud if you're in control of it. So he calls it control fraud. Journalists to this day still haven't caught up to that concept and don't get it. And Trump is a master, a master. He's the greatest con artist in the history of the world, and he knows how to use the conventions of journalism. He's had years of experience at it. And so the problem is, journalists need to recognize they're not covering some politician with sort of far-out views. They are covering someone who is the third-generation head of a four-generation white-collar crime family and someone who is deeply mentally disturbed and at times delusional right in front of them. And you can't cover them the normal way. Now, one of the best suggestions about this, Rose, has been George Lakoff, the University of California Berkeley cognitive scientist, that journalists need to use what he calls a truth sandwich. Say what is going to follow is not true, quote what Trump says, then show that it's not true, instead of quoting Trump and then further down in the story, you know, picking away at it as, well, maybe this is misleading or maybe that isn't true. We need to start recognizing that Donald Trump, just saying he had 16,000 lies doesn't do the job. You've got to focus on that he's doing all these things that are lies, that are improper, that are illegal, and treat him differently. And I don't think at this point stage American journalism is up to it, and we may be seeing the end of our democracy.
Wow. Well, and David, to your point about we need to go further than just a fact check, that is now what we're getting. I mean, most major outlets put out fact checks after the State of the Union address. So, David, if you were back at the New York Times, how would you want to write a piece about that State of the Union address?
Well, I would start off the piece by saying that something like, unlike previous State of the Union addresses that are carefully fact-checked by the staff, Donald Trump last night gave an hour-long talk that was full of misstatements of fact, myths, and outright lies. Can I imagine the Times letting me write a lead like that? Not in a million years. The Post, possibly, and Dan would be a better judge of that, but the Times is so committed to its, you know, wanting to be even-handed and objective that in a breaking news piece, we're going to get this namby-pamby sort of journalism, as Dan mentioned earlier in the show.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what is going on at the Times, because The Daily had on New York Times executive editor Dean Baquet, and it's been getting a lot of attention. And Dan, you actually wrote about this. And, you know, at a time when we see the disappearance of newspapers, the consolidation of media outlets, newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post are increasing their political reporting staff. The New York Times has 21 reporters now covering the elections. And in Dean Baquet's interview with The Daily, Michael Barbaro, he said that, quote, in some cases you engage in deep reporting, but you don't do labeling and cheap analysis. You don't call it a lie. Let somebody else call it a lie. So what were your thoughts about that interview? You wrote a pretty lengthy piece about it.
Yeah, well, I was, you know, deeply disappointed. The ostensible topic was what precisely the topic that you raised at the top of the hour. What have we? What has the press learned from 2016? What has the New York Times learned from 2016? And there's a lot of things you would have hoped the New York Times would have learned from 2016. And you know, chief among them was that they blew Hillary Clinton scandals out of proportion, and they undercovered Donald Trump scandals. But also, what I was hoping was that he would recognize that when you have somebody as abnormal as Donald Trump, you do have to do more than just say what happened. And what Dean McKay said over and over again was his, and this is just the most sort of banal elementary school sort of version of journalism. My job is to think about the reader who wants to pick up the paper and find out, you know, and find out what happened. And so it goes back to exactly what David was saying a minute ago about how that's the way that sort of journalism was raised. But at this point, what happened was that Donald Trump lied. And so you really do have to call out what's going on. And the tragedy is that there are fantastic reporters at the New York Times and at the Washington Post, and they are being squelched, I think. Some of them are doing it willingly, but some of them are being squelched by this kind of thinking that you just, you know, you stay out of it and you just let the reader decide. And ironically, I should mention, by the way, that at a different point of the interview, when Dean McKay was talking about the first article they wrote about Bernie Sanders coming into the race in 2016, he actually defended the journalist sort of saying, you know, the guy he's a socialist and he's a long shot. And he said, sometimes you've got to tell people what to think. So he recognizes that sometimes you do need to explain stuff to people that is beyond just a simple recitation of the facts or stenography. But he doesn't seem to recognize where he is now. And I'll just add the thing that really, the reason why I'm pessimistic, maybe not quite as pessimistic as David, but I'm pessimistic, is that it's hard for these people to change course. Because they're so invested in how they behave and in defending themselves. And so for Dean McKay to say, look, we need to do this differently now, would be just against his nature. So the only thing they could really do is, you know, bring David K. Johnson back as the editor-in-chief. That would be
well, let's play a clip and then we'll get David to respond. So this is the New York Times executive editor Dean McKay being interviewed by Michael Barbaro, the New York Times The Daily podcast.
Yeah, I'm sure you're familiar with this phrase. Yeah. This tendency to represent both sides of a debate as equal, or both sides as having contributed equally to something. And there was a story a couple weeks ago about the impeachment inquiry that was criticized for this. And I read it very carefully. And among the lines people zeroed in on was this. Throughout the committee's debate, the lawmakers from the two parties could not even agree on the basic set of facts in front of them. The criticism was there can only be one set of facts, so lay them out. Another point in the article, it read, quote, they called each other liars and demagogues and accused each other of being desperate and unfair. The criticism of that is that we can tell who is lying or who is not lying based on the testimony and the evidence that we have, but the story didn't do that. It suggested both sides had legitimate, equal cases. Are stories like that a kind of both-sidism abdication?
So I'm going to stick my neck out here, and I'm going to first offer what I think of as a spirited defense for sophisticated objectivity. I think that we're at a moment where people very much want us to take sides. And I don't think that's the right stance for the New York Times. I do think about the person who picks up his paper in the morning and just wants to know what happened. I do think that we have an obligation to that person, and I do fear that we're sort of we're pretending that we don't have that obligation. I do think that American journalism has a tendency to go for the easy version of what I call sophisticated, true objectivity. And the easy version is, I'm writing my story on deadline. Okay, this guy said this guy said that. I'm putting them together, you decide. That's not what I mean when I say sophisticated, true objectivity as a goal. True objectivity is you listen. You're empathetic. If you hear stuff you disagree with, but it's factual and it's worth people hearing, you write about it. Does the New York Times and every news organization in producing tons of stories on deadline fall into on the one hand, on the other hand? Absolutely. Because, you know, when you cover a trial and when you cover some kinds of stories, that's an okay formula. It's not the best formula for covering Donald Trump in the impeachment mm-hmm. trial. And I do think that both siderism and too easily saying on the one hand, on the other hand, is not healthy for the discussion that mm-hmm. we're having.
That is New York Times executive editor Dean Baquet being interviewed by Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily, which is the New York Times podcast. David K. Johnston, you used to work at the New York Times. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, on one level, I can't disagree with anything that was just said by Dean Baquet. On the other hand, he evaded the core of the question by Michael Barbaro, and that is, there's only one set of facts out here. There may be a range of things, just like there's a range of values for your car if you want to sell it or your house. But we have people who are saying diametrically opposite things, and that's not what's being pointed out and covered. We have a president of the United States who yesterday was spreading Russian propaganda. We have Republican congressmen who are repeating what's well established to be Russian propaganda. And the Times and other news organizations aren't labeling it as that, and they should. And it is a factual statement to say President Trump said X. All the American intelligence agencies, as well as those of the countries of X, Y, and Z, say that that's Russian propaganda. And they're not doing that. And most people aren't as sophisticated as Dean wants to believe they are, including Times readers. And I assure you that from the mail I got and the email and the phone calls all the years that I worked there. So there's just a fundamental problem that I don't want the New York Times or any other paper to be pro or anti-Trump in its news pages. I want it to be pro or anti-facts that can be proven, and that's not what's happening here. If the president says things that are false, we should lay them out and say, Donald Trump lied yesterday, and then show it's a lie. Mm.
And the impeachment trial was a perfect example of that, because you really had two very clear sides, and one side was based in facts and evidence, exhaustively produced, and the other was a collection of weird fantasies and ducking of the issue and conspiracy theories. I mean, it could not have been more clear. And so you have Dean Baquet. I mean, I give props to Barbaro for asking that question, because it was exactly the right question to ask. And what is this sophisticated, true objectivity? David, you ever heard of that? That's nuts. Huh?
No, I haven't. And you know, the obligation here falls on the Times, on Baquet, and at the Washington Post on Marty Baron. Neither of the publishers of those papers, Jeff Bezos at the Post and A.J. Sulzberger at the New York Times, they have nothing to do with the newsroom. If they tried to interfere in the newsroom, all hell would break loose over it. If I were still working there and Sulzberger tried to in some way interfere with the news report, it would take me just minutes to organize everybody to walk out on the sidewalk.
But nor are they being influenced by the White House, you know, in some sort of nefarious way. These you know, that's not the way it works.
Yeah, it is. So this makes the case that the conventions of journalism are not designed to cover a criminal and a con artist and a mentally ill person in the office of the President of the United States, and to the detriment of our republic. And it's hard to change. You know, ExxonMobil, arguably the best managed company in the world, in a very nasty business, but a really well-managed company, they're never going to be a green company. You know how much they try to tell you they're going to be. It's not going to happen. There's not a single example in large business enterprises of somebody morphing into a direct change to what they were. So I think it's important that we have organizations like DC Report, like the new project that Dan has to watch the press, the criticisms of Jay Rosen. The problem is all of us together, we're a tiny little pipsqueak compared to the established market influence of the big organizations, and especially the New York Times, because every significant editor and broadcast person in the country's first thing they do when they get up in the morning is look to see what's in the New York Times.
Right. And David, you've been on the show many times talking about media consolidation and just journalists being laid off, newspapers shutting down, and the New York Times is really growing to grab those people.
Yes, there's a bigger staff now than when I left in 2008. And that's terrific, and I'm glad that they have more resources, and they're doing a lot of things that are really great and innovative, particularly data reporting, the incredible coverage they've done of how the Chinese are oppressing the Uyghurs. Mm-hmm. There's lots of good things here. I don't want to tar the paper, but there is a clear problem in American journalism in how Trump is covered. Now, our part of it at DC Report is we focus on what is being done to our government. And I can tell you one of the lessons we've learned from that is a lot of people don't care. They don't care. It is a niche market, and we've sadly come to recognize that. And we also have come to realize that the level of cynicism among people, all politicians are crooks. No, they're not. All politicians lie all the time. Absolutely not true. So maybe we also need some reporting that points out, here's somebody, say, one of the candidates running for president who consistently is telling the truth or something in the reasonable range of truth, as opposed to just flat-out lying about things.
David,
and I just want to add one thing,
sure,
which
Dan.
Is that the problem doesn't go away, you know, when Trump does.
Exactly.
I think that David is right, that this is the most incredible example of how how the press can't cover something. But even when it's not Trump anymore, what Trump has done is actually exploited a lot of problems that existed before that were already being exploited to a lesser degree for a long time. Part of it has to do with the increasing asymmetry between the political parties as far as their relationship to the truth, which is not purely a Trump phenomenon. And the other is just in general, this sort of drive to shallow coverage, to spectacle, the natural tendency to just sort of equate everything and to just suggest that the debate lies entirely between the two political parties. And those are the only two sustainable positions to being, to the sort of amnesia and not trusting experts. I mean, there's a ton of stuff that we need to work on. That Trump has exploited. He's done a great job of sort of showcasing it, but it doesn't go away after he leaves.
Dan Frumkin is the founder of Presswatch, a media project that monitors political reporting and encourages more informed and informative campaign and government coverage during the 2020 election. Presswatch says we are entering a critical period in American politics and American political journalism is not up to the task. Over 12 years at The Washington Post, Dan served as editor of the website and wrote its popular White House Watch column. We're also joined today by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning and investigative reporter who has covered Donald Trump for decades. David is the best-selling author of 7 books, including The Making of Donald Trump, and It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is the founder and editor-in-chief of the nonpartisan, nonprofit news service DC Report, which focuses on what politicians do rather than what they say. David is a former reporter with the New York Times. So we've got David, who used to work for the Times, Dan, who used to work for the Post, and they have started their own news outlets. So if you have any questions for them or comments about just the questions that came up this week is, what did the media learn from 2016? So any questions for Dan or David, we'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we're joined by Dan Frumkin, former Washington Post reporter who is the founder of Presswatch, a media project that monitors political reporting. David K. Johnston is a former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, founder of DC Report. They focus on what politicians do rather than what they say. And if you have any questions or comments for David and Dan, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. David, we have had you on so many times talking about the real state of the economy. You've got a piece called Trump's Ho-Hum Economy in 3 Graphs. And, you know, we can mention these statistics, which we do constantly. The wealthiest 10% of households own more than 90% of stocks and mutual funds. The big winners of the past 3 years under Trump have been the rich rather than the working people. The question is, What do we do at a time when, according to Nieman Lab, this is the headline, Republicans and Democrats live in nearly inverse news media environments, according to Pew. So you've got the overwhelming majority of Republicans listening to Fox, Hannity, and Limbaugh. And then Democrats, they've got a wide range of sources, CNN, New York Times, PBS, NPR, NBC. So, David, I mean, how do you deal with that crisis?
Well, first of all, it's important to understand this is not necessarily a new phenomenon in America. If you go back and look at what went on during the period when President Andrew Johnson was impeached and news coverage, people got very, very echo chamber sort of news back then. But this is an era here where we're dealing with television and its powerful impact on how people think and organize their minds. And there's a growing amount of research about how once you get sold on something, whatever it is, if it's not true, it's almost impossible to get people to back off and walk away from that. It's one of the reasons that con artists do so well, and you periodically will see a story of, you know, some guy who retires and discovers his wife lost all their money in a Nigerian email scam, or vice versa, the wife retires and finds out the husband did it, and never, you know, the other spouse was hidden from them because the person couldn't bring themselves to recognize they'd been had. So this problem is a real challenge to democracy. And I'm worried less about Donald, who is the symptom of the problem, not the problem itself, than what happens if we get someone who has all of Donald's charisma but has deep philosophical roots, is a very hardworking person, is a competent executive, and who wants to destroy our democracy. That's the person who we really need to worry about, and we're simply not prepared to deal with that. And I don't know the answer to that. I'm mostly in the diagnosis business more than the solutions business. Mm.
What are your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very important and tough question. I don't have the answer either. I do think, however, though, that this ties into what I was saying before, which is that you when you look at this, you know, the spectrum of the media that Nieman was talking about in this Pew report, on the one hand, it's the New York Times, on the other hand, it's Fox News. That's a bizarre continuum, and the New York Times needs to sort of realize that it's on that continuum, and so. I'm pretty sure that what Dean Baquet was really trying to say was, I have confidence that my readers will understand what's really true. And that may be well-founded, actually. I've been sort of thinking about that. But what he doesn't keep in mind is that it's not just his readers. The New York Times also is a wire service. The news stories go out all over the country. Just like David said, it's you know, the established voice, and so everybody, you know, news people all over the country and the world turn to it to sort of get a sense of what is the appropriate response to this news event. So they need to really be as assertive about the truth as, you know, Fox is assertive about its fictions, and so that would help, I think. That would make it seem less okay that Fox is out there spouting this stuff, and that people would go back, hopefully, to being, you know, ashamed of watching it.
Rose, there is a long-term solution to this, which is that we need to update our public education system, which was designed in the 19th century to produce office and industrial drones. We need to teach critical thinking skills, mm-hmm. and so that Americans grow up with the same skills that my friend who grew up in Siberia has. His knowledge of American history and our conflicts is vastly superior to anybody I know who isn't a history professor, for example. Hmm. And he just got a regular education in Siberia.
Yeah, I found the same thing in Europe about 4 months ago. I mean, so many people know about so many different things and so much about what's happening here in the United States. What about this comment from Robert? He says that the problem is not the media, it's politics. Trump voters don't care if he lies. They know he does, and it's fine with them. He says that's not a media problem, that's a political problem. David, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that that's true. I think we have a real moral breakdown going on in our society. And we have a significant portion of the population, I've long estimated it's about a third of us, who hate the civil rights movement. You can't go around in polite society saying, I want to go back to putting women and minorities in their place. In fact, there's actually a movement out there to repeal the 14th Amendment, which I had a very hard time getting in the New York Times. I got one little story about it, quoting Congressman Paul, Ron Paul, on this point. But there are a lot of people who they may love their idea of America, but they hate the America we have, where minorities of various kinds now have growing numbers and political influence. And that's the core of who Donald is appealing to. Without any question, that's why the Medal of Freedom was given to the racist Rush Limbaugh at the State of the Union.
Mm. Racist and sexist, I will add. I've been reading.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, I've been reading comments that he's made in the past, and I mean, it's shocking. I mean, even NPR said he's controversial to some, and it stopped me in my tracks, and I thought, to some. It's been so interesting to watch how national media have been covering the Freedom of Medal and Rush Limbaugh and all the horrific things he said. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter who is a former reporter with the New York Times, and he's the founder of DC Report. They focus on what politicians do rather than what they say. Dan Frumkin is a former Washington Post reporter, founder of Press Watch, a media project that monitors political reporting. Now I'd like to welcome Zach Carter to the show. Zach is senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post and author of the forthcoming book, The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Hi, Zach. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been spending most of the show talking about how the media cover Trump and how they should cover Trump. What are your thoughts on this, Zach, as a political economy reporter? I mean, how are you covering Trump, what he says and what's actually fact?
I'll be perfectly honest. It's very difficult, and I don't have a set of hard rules or anything that I follow. The way I have generally tried to deal with it is by not covering Donald Trump and focusing on other things. So we have other reporters who cover Trump here in the White House. Jen Bendery, I think, does a very good job with it. I think there's a sort of central dilemma where. You know, do you want to amplify the things that the president is doing because they, by most traditional standards, are newsworthy? But at the same time, a lot of what he does is just a media stunt. A lot of it just spreads conspiracy theories. You know, even if you try to fact check something he says, it's totally flagrantly false. It's not obvious to me that has a positive effect on society. It may just end up dispersing the claim even further. So to be perfectly honest, I don't know. I think it's a tough spot, and I think we are fortunate that there are so many journalists in this country that are working hard to do their best at it, but I definitely think it's a difficult thing.
Let's spend a little bit of time talking about the economy, because this is such an important issue. And today, headline news right now, I'm reading from the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNBC, January adds a much stronger than expected 225,000 jobs. This is going to be headline news today. David, this was a big part of Trump's. In fact, he started off with it at the State of the Union about how the economy is doing so great. How do you write about this at a time when, if you have a stock portfolio, it is off the charts? I mean, when you look at where Apple and other companies are, it's like Apple's at, I think, $320 a share today. How do you report about the economy with such massive inequality?
Well, let's just take the jobs number. The jobs growth in the last year was 13% less per month than during the period from when the economy recovered in jobs, the October of 2010, to the end of Obama's presidency. Job growth has slowed significantly under Donald Trump. It keeps growing, but it is at a much slower pace. The increase in wages for people at the bottom is in large part, not entirely, but in large part, driven by increases in the minimum wage in blue states and blue cities. And, of course, the Trump administration wants to get rid of the minimum wage, which at the federal level has been stuck at $7.25 since 2009, and for restaurant tipped workers at $2.13 since 1993. So Donald picks and chooses numbers. The stock market is not an indicator of how the economy is doing overall. And the growth of the economy overall doesn't mean necessarily better times. For example, this is an outrageous example, but if you wanted to stimulate the GDP growth, we could encourage a big crime wave that would result in the hiring of a lot more detectives to pursue criminals and lawyers to deal with them in court and people to put them in prison. And the economy would grow, even though it would be negative to the general welfare.
Zach, what are your thoughts on this? I thought this headline was good out of the New York Times. As the economy soars, so does the number of homeless students in public schools. Why? And according to this piece, more than 1.5 million public school students nationwide said they were homeless at some point during the 2017-2018 school year. This is according to the National Center for Homeless Education. So I thought that they did a great job because some people are just doing extremely well, and yet so many of us are seeing the homeless crisis just get worse in our own backyard.
Well, particularly in big cities, and part of that is the way that demographics have changed, so that homelessness is more concentrated in specific areas now rather than being spread across wider areas. But in New York, where I live, I mean, there are well over 100,000 homeless children any given day of the week, and that's a figure that just ought to be criminal. it's shocking. You know, we're the wealthiest country in the history of wealthy countries, and I agree with everything that David just said about the economy under Trump. But we're also, you know, in an economic expansion that's been going on for more than 10 years now. This is a, or almost 10 years rather. So there is clearly a section of the country which our economic policymaking simply ignores. And it's substantial. I mean, there are well over 30 million people in the United States. I think it's about 38 million officially living in poverty. People dispute the number of people living in less than $2 a day, critical poverty rates that places like the World Bank use to describe, you know, severe poverty in developing countries. But there are at least 300,000 people, even by the most sort of generous estimate, in the United States, living on less than $2 a day. So clearly, we have a huge problem with inequality. But the stuff that we've been talking about here is mostly stuff about absolute poverty, right? Where we're talking about people who are homeless, people who are living on less than $2 a day. There's also a power dynamic that is, I think, even it should be just as alarming to people. The fact that people with, right now in the Democratic Party primary, somebody with well over $50 billion is pretty flagrantly trying to buy the Democratic presidential nomination just by running a barrage of ads in all of the Super Tuesday states. I think he spent over $200 million so far, or something around $200 million. Right. Just never happened in American politics. So we clearly have a situation where people at the very top not only are well off and don't have to worry about material comfort, they certainly believe that they're capable of doing of exerting enormous control over the political system, just by virtue of their wealth and nothing else, while homeless children, you know, have no functional say in our political process.
And since you brought up Bloomberg, this hasn't gotten much attention, but Al Jazeera had a piece about him when he was mayor, and the homeless shelter beds, the number of people in homeless shelters each night under Bloomberg went from 31,000 to 54,000. Dan Frumkin, what about the basic question here of who the economy is working for? What other questions should the media be asking?
Right. Well, I think there is a lot to be thought about here in terms of what does the media cover? And so, yeah, the media will cover the fact that the jobs report came out yesterday, and the media reacts to things that are announced. But if you were sitting down and starting a newsroom from scratch today, you know, you'd probably think to yourself, well, what are the big issues that I want to educate, you know, the American public about? And I think pretty quickly you would realize there's really two huge overarching issues that are more important than almost anything else. And one is inequality, and the other is climate change. And so theoretically, you would then basically view everything that you write about through that lens. And so I do think that that it's incumbent on the press to, when it is writing stories, incremental stories about the economy, to look through that lens of inequality. I think that would make a big difference.
And then, Zach, we wanted to bring you on because with all the news about impeachment and the Iowa caucus, there's very little news about the trade war with China, which was getting so much attention for a couple of months. But after Trump unveiled phase one of the agreement, there's been really little about what's in the agreement or what it means for people who will be impacted. I mean, most of the coverage was about how this was a bipartisan bill. You had a number of environmental groups like the Sunrise Movement and Food and Water Action opposing this deal. What really stands out for you about what's actually in this deal and how it will affect workers and the environment?
Well, there are a couple of different pieces from the Trump administration's trade agenda that came down the last couple months. One of them was the sort of attempt to overhaul the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is a deal between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And the other one is this agreement with China, which is an attempt to resolve the sort of tariff fighting back and forth that's been going on for the past couple of years under the Trump administration. Both are pretty complicated and have a lot of details, but I think on the China deal, essentially nothing has happened. I just think, you know, if you want to nitpick on specific details, you could make some points, but we essentially are not changing our trade policy with China from where it was when Trump entered office, which I think is a missed opportunity. You know, I think there's a lot to criticize in the way President Trump has handled the tariff fight with China, but the basic idea of using tariffs as a way to change the trading relationship with China is not a bad idea. It's something that was becoming more mainstream even among some traditionally sort of more center-right-ish economists as Trump came into office, in part, I think, just because Trump campaigned on bashing the free trade deal for the last 30 years. But, you know, we have a problem in the United States where a lot of what we manufacture, stuff that has significant national security value, isn't available in the United States. It has to be made through supply chains, particularly supply chains that go through China. And the government in China is, not always a reliable partner on a lot of issues. And I think politically it makes sense to try and reorient some of those supply chains. It's sort of an example of what David was talking about earlier, where, you know, you can talk about the economic costs and growth and productivity and stuff, and all of that stuff matters. But if you become extremely dependent on vulnerable supply chains that are vulnerable to your group, political instability or, environmental instability, whatever you have, your numbers are hiding a problem. So I think that was actually, a sane thing to do, even though it was a break with recent precedent. But I just don't think the president delivered on it. There's really not much to say from the agreement other than we spent 2 years going back and forth and spending about $30 billion subsidizing American farmers to deal with some retaliatory tariffs that China put up against us. It just doesn't really seem like it seems like we're back at square one.
David, you've written about trade for a long time, and Trump is going to be boasting and campaigning on trade. What about just basic facts? Like the Economic Policy Institute's Robert Scott wrote in a recent piece about this, and he said all of this globalized trade has reduced the wages of about 100 million Americans by roughly $2,000 a year. He also says that about 90,000 U.S. factories have been lost. So how do you think the media should cover this? Because this definitely will be a campaign issue.
Well, they need to do it with a little more perspective and looking at the numbers. Essentially, when we opened up, when Nixon went to China and we began to open up relations with China and made some other deals, what you saw was a labor arbitrage. A stock arbitrage is where you find out you can buy a stock for a nickel on one market and sell it for a dime on another, and you can make money off of that spread. Well, by replacing American industrial workers with workers in China or Mexico or Vietnam who get far lower wages, you can improve your profits if you have enough scale. You have to be big enough to do it. better than anything else you can possibly do because labor is such a large part of your costs. And so that's what the companies have been doing. They've been responding to that. But Zach is exactly right that we've created a system now where some of our national security interests are dependent on the Chinese being cooperative, and at the same time, China's leading general on the issue of strategy has written papers that are widely read by the Chinese military that war with the United States is inevitable and the duty of the People's Liberation Army is to prepare itself for that. So how we get people to understand and think about trade and the economic impacts and the fact that Trump has accomplished nothing and may have actually done very permanent damage to soybean farmers in the Midwest, it's pretty abstract to a lot of people. That's a real problem here. The world is getting more and more complicated there, and I think it's not something that resonates with people in their souls unless you're a farmer or a supplier who's been affected by the trade wars that Trump ginned up.
You know, if I could, I think this is one place where campaign coverage might actually be clarifying, especially if it's good, especially once, you know, the Democrats settle on a nominee. You know, Trump, he basically campaigned on you know, sticking up for the little guy who's been screwed over by, you know, bad trade agreements and globalization. And then, as Zach said, he's not actually delivered. But if the Democrats can actually get the media to focus on the question of has he or has he not delivered and what would it take to deliver and would the Democratic plans be better, that would be a good conversation for the country to have.
Agreed.
Well, I want to read a couple questions from listeners. Ruth writes, mentioning Fox, Rupert Murdoch's power through newspapers and television here and around the world, Britain's Brexit issues, Australia, and his focus on suffocating climate issues, North America, and all of his influence, what can be done about this? Rupert has entrance and influence with all of the leaders of these countries. Anyone want to take that?
I have a rule
in
my house, which is no time machine solutions, but that's the only thing I could think of.
David or Zach?
Well, Murdoch is now in the latter half of his 80s, and eventually his sons, who appear to be much more moderate, particularly Lachlan, are going to take charge. But, you know, they're all totally commercial animals, and if it is in the economic interests of Murdoch's enterprises to destroy the country, they'll do it. They just are thinking about, you know, their empire and their money, and this is a very unfortunate development.
We have another question.
I'm more pessimistic than
Zach.
David, if that's possible. I think there's been a sort of broader turn, not just in the United States, but in Europe and Latin America and the rest of the world, where the right is sort of moving away from the sort of free trade and free markets kind of neoliberal model that has dominated it for the last 30 or 40 years, and towards a more like openly authoritarian idea of conservatism. And I think that's kind of more where Rupert Murdoch is. You can see it in his coverage in a lot of other countries. It's not just the United States. And I think there are going to be political pressures in a global empire, a media empire like the Murdochs, that's pushed that form of conservatism in other places as well.
A question for you, David. Will we ever see Trump's taxes?
Yeah, I think we ultimately will. Trump is asserting that the state of New York, through the Manhattan DA, cannot go after his tax returns and business records from third parties before he took office. We have never had a ruling from the Supreme Court that says that your immunities and privileges as the executive under the Constitution extend to before you took office. So I would expect the Supreme Court's going to allow that to proceed. Even if it doesn't, at some point, particularly after we get a new administration, we will see them. If Trump loses the Electoral College, he will lose the popular vote without any question in the next election. If he loses the Electoral College, I think whoever the Democrats nominate needs to be nailed down by reporters that they will absolutely see to it that there are investigations of Trump's criminal activity, including his tax cheating and whether or not they're pursued, the public should know what happened.
Hmm. Well, we have about a minute left. Why don't you tell us what you're working on? Dan, what are you working on?
Trying to get funding for Press Lives.
Yep, we feel you.
No, I mean, I keep on looking for the good and the bad. I mean, what I'm trying to do with Press Watch is not just highlight the worst practices, but also find best practices and coalesce people who are really smart, like, you know, David and Zach and others, around a sense that there is a positive model for how to do this.
What about you, David? What are you working on?
Well, we'll have a trade piece based partly on Robert Scott's work next week. And I'm also now back working on my plan for an entirely new tax code for the 21st century economy. Almost done.
Was that all, David? That's all?
Yeah, minor project.
What about you, Zach?
Well, before I say that, I just want to vouch for Dan. We used to work together. He's great. Press Watch is outstanding. I'm working on promoting a book. I have a book coming out in May. It's a biography of John Maynard Keynes, and trying to popularize the idea that there is a whole political philosophy embedded in Keynesianism. It's not just debt and deficit. So related to what we've been talking about today.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have you on when that comes out. Zach Carter, a senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. David K. Johnston is former New York Times reporter, who's founder and editor-in-chief of DC Report, focusing on what politicians do rather than what they say. Dan Frumkin, former reporter with The Washington Post, is founder of Presswatch, a media project that monitors political reporting. Dan, David, and Zach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Jonathan Linden, our intern, and David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.